Good morning, please be seated.
Good morning.
Good morning. Welcome to the September session of Nebraska Court of Appeals. We are pleased to be back in our courtroom, also both live and also by WebEx video streaming. We have followed the protocols for cleaning the courtroom in between arguments, and we appreciate counsel following our protocols for your safety and our safety. We ask that you keep your mask on while you're seated at council table, but when you approach the bench to make your argument, you may remove it and then put it back on when you're finished. And at the conclusion of the arguments, then we'll ask you to leave by the side door. So with that, I'll make some introductions. My name is Frankie Moore. I'm from North Platte, and I'm joined on the bench to my left by Judge Larry Welch of Plattsmouth. We're pleased to have Judge Rico Bishop of Lincoln via WebEx, and you'll be able to see her on your screen when she is asking a question. So with that, I believe we're ready to begin. This case is Yeider versus Barber. Counsel, when you're ready, you may approach.
Good morning, Judge Moore, Judge Welch, and Judge Bishop, and counsel. May it please the court. My name is Matthew Higgins, and I'm the attorney for Jesse Barber. And Mr. Barber has taken an appeal from the decision of Judge Cox in Sarpy County on two items that were tried, I believe it was late last year. Those two items are whether or not the judge was justified in modifying the parenting plan, or whether he was justified in modifying it the way that he went ahead and did it. And the second item, though they're reversed in my brief, is whether or not the child support award was within Nebraska law or whether it was reasonable at all to begin with. Now, assuming the court has read my brief, I'll not waste your time with the rather short list of facts and get right to what I think is, I haven't come up with a better word for this, the fiddly bits of my arguments. And probably the fiddliest part is this parenting plan. And you'll see in the parenting plan that the judge orders weekly telephone visits of no less than 15 minutes. And that sounds specific. And I understand that given Mr. Barber's circumstance, that he's incarcerated, that could pass muster. That's enough. I read the case law, I see that. But my problem is this, Mr. Barber's problem is this. If you look at Ms. Yeider's testimony, she may be saying words like, yes, we can do phone visits, but when pressed for even a single specific at all, nothing, no suggestions made by opposing counsel or by Ms. Yeider on the stand. And the judge's order has a mechanism for resolving disputes that I don't think is available to Mr. Barber. It is, first, the judge lists a weekly parenting schedule of every other weekend and holidays, which of course he cannot exercise. Gives him 15-minute a week phone visits. But the other thing that the judge does is the parties are to work out arrangements for all the visitation. And if they can't work it out, they got to mediate. Now, he didn't use the word mediator. He used the word talk to some persons, and I want to be too, but it was pretty casual. Talk to some persons to see if those persons could help them resolve the issue. I think that award, given that what Ms. Yeider had said at trial about her willingness to do this, coupled with, I think, a burdensome provision to sort out what visitation is supposed to be when she really has no motivation to do this at all, is an error that needs to be corrected. And the minimal correction would be is, how about just some specifics? How about saying things like, any Wednesday, with a time
so,
that he...
Yeah, so counsel, I understand your position here. I think... Broadly stated, you think the custodial parent currently has a veto power. If the custodial parent vetoes it, it goes to mediation, try and figure out. And with respect to the time, manner, and extent of visitation, and it's the court's obligation to do that. So I would ask you, what is your position with regard to what does the court do in a situation like this where the non-custodial parent is incarcerated? How do you go about the time, manner, or setting forth the time and manner of visitation? Does the court need to have a full understanding of the visitation schedule of the prison? I mean, give us your position in that regard.
Your Honor, I think that you could do this with a not-so-elaborate mechanism that goes something like this, that Ms. Yeider would make the child available to the grandparents for their scheduled phone visitation with their son. And you can see in the record that they talked to Mr. Barber talks to his parents every week, and what could be set up is Mr. Barber could say something like, well, I know every Wednesday at 3 o'clock, I'll have phone privileges. So that's what we're going to do. The judge could have said, just find out whatever times you're available once a week to do this. There's got to be some sort of pattern here. And those would be the time, that would be the time that would be used, as opposed to just leaving it wide open. Again, I know it doesn't give a specific number or day, but the mechanism would be that Mr. Barber would simply publish to the other side when he could be available, and that would be the new schedule. That would be simple enough, as opposed to him trying to get phone privileges, clearing it through counsel or through a mediator, however that would work, and then Ms. Barber may or may not agree to it.
So in that regard, is there anything in the record currently that the court could look at and say, okay, well, these are the available times that you can visit, or would you have to open back up this record to try and figure out how you set the time and manner of a visitation schedule as it relates to the non-custodial parent that's incarcerated?
I think you would have to open up the evidence again to do that. And at the time of the trial, there was no way to determine that fact. At the time of the trial, Mr. Barber had yet to go to the penitentiary, and he was in the correction center. And so there was no way he also, and again, this is not in the record, but it's one reason generally for any incarcerated person. Mr. Barber finds himself being segregated a lot because of the nature of his offense. I mean, he is locked away sometimes 23 hours a day without interaction with other inmates or anything like this. So the idea that this 1 hour he gets to go in the yard when he is in the Mr. Shinsey's the criminal defense lawyer, protective custody or being sequestered away because he's persona non grata even at prison because of the nature of his offense. I just don't see how this would work. He manages to get phone privileges. He calls Ms. Uter? And she says, yes, you can talk to him. No, I think the court could have done a little bit better job just in that one regard. Give us a specific or give us a mechanism by which that specific can reveal itself later. In other words, okay, Mr. Barber, when you figure out whatever day that's going to be, you publish that to Ms. Uter, and that's when the visitation will take place.
I want to ask about the order, though. The other part you complain about is that the provision about other parenting time being basically dictated by the custodial parent if she agrees with the request. That's not in relation to the telephone visits.
No, Your Honor, that's separate. In a way, I'll say this in the most generous way, it's not an order at all. It's here's what your visitation is, but if Ms. Uter says not so much, then there's no visitation. She may say yes to these things. She may not say yes to these things. And then we're faced with when Mr. Barber gets out of prison, we're faced with what's the change in circumstance? He now has this order that was done while he was in prison. And it seems to the intention of the judge was to make this serviceable after he gets out, because there's no way he could do every other weekend and holidays and such. So we'd like to take all that authority away from her and just, as opposed to giving it to Mr. Barber, give the authority to a rule. And that rule—
To a what?
To a rule, to a mechanism to determine what the time should be. If there's any other questions on the visitation issue, I'd like to say a few words regarding the support issue. I noticed when I reread my brief a couple of times that there's a sentence that says something to the effect of that Mr. Barber had employment, now he doesn't, and therefore there's no change in circumstance. That sounds like an absurdity. But what I was getting at, and hopefully I did this justice, is that when the parties initially did the paternity order and support order, there was no child support ordered, but then there was some justification given in the order. It says due to the relative economic circumstances of the parties, no support will be paid except for daycare. Record reflects Mr. Barber was Curtin's daycare continuously, never missed a payment right up to the day he went to prison. He took all his visitation without exception, not contradicting the testimony. And so when the judge says, you know, determines he has $3,000 a month in income, well, that's about the income he had back when the first order was set.
Do we have the first order in our record?
I think the order, I thought that it was in the record, if I'm mistaken.
That's a problem for us if we don't have that order in the record as it relates to your specific assignment here, is it not?
Well, Your Honor, I can review the materials again. I assume that either the order or not.
Let me approach it a different way.
Yes, sir.
In addition to the issue of what that original order said, well, you're not sure as of right now whether that order is in there or not.
And yes, sir, that's why I've got three arguments on the support issue. Two of them were dependent upon the terms of the order and one was not.
Would you agree that previously, it appears at least from your pleading, that there was a joint custody award before, and now after this order, there was sole custody in the mother, correct?
I don't think that was the case, Your Honor.
Well, please explain what it was.
Well, before. What ended up happening is the visitation provision, again, I recited in my brief, was that as what the parties may agree. That was Judge Astaire's complete visitation provision, what the parties may agree. And Mr. Barber filed his lawsuit based upon the fact that he was being denied a visitation. He wanted a specific schedule. So Judge Zastera on temporaries modified the decree temporarily to give him a specific visitation schedule. We were asking for joint custody. That's what we're asking for. Now, I see I've run out of time. Would the court indulge me 1 minute to make my last argument on charge?
Well, I have to ask a specific question.
Yes, sir.
The fact that now your client is incarcerated, that's a material change in circumstances. Would you agree with that? As it relates to whatever the original custody award was?
Yes, sir.
And does that not warrant then changing the support obligation?
It would change it, but I think it'd be semantic, wouldn't it? If there was no support based upon what he earned before, and they established that the court said it was $3,000 a month, and now we've established he earns nothing. And if you look at the justification in the Rouse case, referencing the statute stating that if A, that's not a, incarceration is not a voluntary loss of employment, it's involuntary, and two, he meets the statutory language of a 3 month reduction, which would be reasonably expected to last for 6 months more. So he met that provision, and he doesn't come under any of the prohibitions of he didn't commit a crime against a child that they have between the two of them. He's not in prison for not paying support, and he's abided by all the court orders. And he's not in for violence against his uter. So it seems to me that the Rouse justification in the statute would seem to suggest that if there's going to be a decision on child support, it would be that he pays nothing. I mean, I think the language that the court used in one of the previous cases, Hopkins, I believe, is that they were trying to avoid an absurd result, which we would certainly have, because Mr. Barber would get out of prison, let's say 6 years from now, even at $50 a month, he would have a nut to crack before.
So you don't take the position that the court erred in modifying at all. You're saying that as it relates to how it was modified, it's modified incorrectly.
It just got it wrong.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
And thank you for the additional time.
You're welcome. And how much additional time was there, Mr. Lee?
2 minutes even.
If you would add that to the appellee's time, if he so desires, thank you.
May I be seated?
Yes, you may. Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Don Shenzi. I represent the appellee, Kristen Yeider. May it please the court, Mr. Higgins. This particular case, I would respectfully submit to the court, is not complex nor difficult. It's rather sad, and it's tragic because of the circumstances surrounding Mr. Barber and the daughter of my client, the conviction and sentence of which was affirmed by this court just yesterday, Mr. Barber's conviction and sentence out of Dawes County. So that matter has been resolved by this court as of yesterday. So when I say this is a tragic case from a set of the factual circumstances surrounding it, that's what I am alluding to. I would respectfully submit also that Judge Cox did not abuse his discretion. Judge Cox used the evidence that was before him and that was adduced at trial through the through the testimony of Mrs. Barber, the mother of Mr. Barber. Obviously, he was not present because he had been in the state penitentiary for 4 months at the time trial commenced in this matter. So Mrs. Barber, I guess to her credit, stepped in and offered testimony on behalf of her son. Now, what did that testimony show? The testimony showed through Mrs. Barber, my client, and an affidavit supplied through these judicial proceedings during the course of this the proceedings in front of Judge Cox that Mr. Barber had offered an exhibit, which is number 20 at trial. And it's also so it's part of the record about his earning capacity. So not only did Judge Cox have the benefit of both parties offering testimony about relative income of Mr. Barber, but also an affidavit attesting to under oath what his earning capacity was and what he was earning. That's important, obviously, because that figure then was used by Judge Cox, along with the reduced figure of my client of $66,000 per year as a nurse, to then calculate, pursuant to the Nebraska Child Support calculations, what the proper amount should be per month. Now, how does that tie in? It ties in because Mr. Barber commenced these proceedings. As a result, we filed, or my client filed, an answer and a cross complaint. That cross complaint was filed on the 24th of July of 2017. Mr. Barber was put on notice for about 16 months prior to the time that he was sentenced that we were seeking against him a judgment for the child support that we asked for back in July of 17. And then he was sentenced in November of 2018. And then we finally get to trial in March of 2019. So there can be no question of what we asked for, not only in our cross complaint, but also in the prayer of our cross complaint, that we were seeking this child support from the time of the filing of the answer and cross complaint. Judge Cox used the evidence that was available and also testimony that was available pursuant to the two witnesses and the affidavit to support his conclusion. Now, in terms of this Hopkins case and the Rouse case, I would simply point out to the court that in my opinion, those cases are clearly distinguishable from the present case. These two cases, as I read them, and as I recall the factual basis of both, were initiated by people who were already in the penitentiary, who had a longstanding child support order against them, and they were seeking to modify that, obviously to lower it, the obligation, while they were incarcerated. Again, in this particular case, the cross complaint was filed in July of 17. Mr. Barber goes to jail in November of 18. Now, the trial court, Judge Cox, when he issued his order, issued the order from 1 August of 17 through 1 December of 18 for the child support that was requested through the cross complaint and in the prayer of the cross complaint. The $50 thereafter was to begin then on the 1st of January of 19. And then, of course, as we all know, once Mr. Barber would get out, he would have the ability to, if he so desired, to or my client for that matter, to file a modification at that point. But there's no question about the historical, the factual sequence of events here and how this all played out. So my position.
Do you believe the record reflects that Mr. Barber was not required to pay child support at the commencement of this case?
Well, I would say that typically, at least in my experience, and this is in my opinion, the trial court was not in a position, nor did it desire to have an order on the cross complaint regarding any child support up until it was determined that a modification had in fact occurred. And once the finding was found that material change in circumstances had occurred, then the modification could commence from the date of the filing of the cross complaint. Again, back to July of 17. Clearly, Judge Cox was correct when he found that the appellant, Mr. Barber, failed to meet his burden of proof as to a material change in circumstances. Ms. Yeider, on the other hand, clearly met hers under existing case law and statute. The father of the minor child had been convicted in Dawes County. He got 10 to 12 years. He was sentenced in November of 18. So presumably, given the opinion of this court from yesterday, absent any recourse Mr. Barber receives through his ineffective assistance of counsel claims that obviously he'll probably advance at some point, he's going to serve another 3 years until he is eligible for parole and another four until he jams out. So that is the future for Mr. Barber. Now, in terms of the, if I could move on, and I'll come back if the court has any questions, but as to the parenting plan, there's two statutes in Nebraska that I made mention of in my brief on page 13. That's 43-29-23-1, about what's in the best interest of the child when it comes to a parenting arrangement. And also I referenced 43-29-23 sub 6 sub d little d and 43-903. All of the factors that the trial court can look at when determining the best interest of the child. And I really wanted to focus on sub D of 43-29-23-6, and that is credible evidence of abuse inflicted on any family or a household member. Well, we all need to remember, and it's clear from my argument and Mr. Higgins, that we all know that Mr. Barber was convicted of first-degree sexual assault on a child. And because of that conviction, he was sentenced accordingly to 10 to 12 years in the Nebraska State Penitentiary. But given the affirmation of the conviction and sentence by this court yesterday, we know approximately how much time Mr. Barber will still serve. There can be no question.
Mr. Shensi, excuse me.
Yes.
So does the fact that he's incarcerated somehow change the line of authority that says that one parent can't be the final decision maker with regard to parenting time? And isn't that what the court did in this parenting plan? Didn't it improperly delegate to the mother the final say on when things, maybe when telephone calls would occur, when he'd be able to have any kind of parenting time when that becomes available?
In all fairness, probably, but somebody's got to make that decision. And as I recall, Judge Cox termed it a general parenting plan. I think that was in the order or in the record, a general parenting plan, knowing that at some point it was going to have to be modified. And speaking for the trial court, I'll give my opinion as to the rationale. It was because of the incarceration, the fact that the stepsister of the minor child in question had been the victim of the sexual assault, given the time that Mr. Barber was going to spend in prison, giving the ruling of this court yesterday, confirming that, and given the fact that Mr. Barber now is a registered sex offender under Nebraska statute, all of these factors I would respectfully submit to this court weighed in favor of my client, Ms. Yeider, having the decision-making, I hate to use the word power, but the discretion in determining what appropriate time would be available for visitation. My client,
there's no existing case law that says that because the non-custodial parent is incarcerated, that somehow should change the current rule or obligation of the court or the duty of the court to set the time, manner, and extent of visitation.
I think there has to be a little leeway in that regard in a case where somebody is incarcerated. I never got the impression from Judge Cox once that he, in fact, he found that the Mr. Barber should be involved in the child's life. There was no indication or conclusion drawn by the court in its order that Mr. Barber should somehow be excluded from seeing his son. Just to the contrary, but it was problematic. And why was it problematic? Because Mr. Barber, through counsel, insisted that my client couldn't tell the boy, the minor boy, about where dad is, where's daddy? So they insisted to Judge Cox that she not tell him that. Like, your dad's in prison for doing something to your stepsister. Yet they come before this court now and they want some sort of visitation plan in place where he would be taken to the penitentiary.
I appreciate that, but in your limited time here, is there some sort of practical impossibility associated with the court learning what the visitation schedule or ability to call the days, the times that are available, and setting a plan based on that? Is there anything about that that would be problematic?
Well, just maybe the pandemic at this point, that might be problematic. Right. However long that's going to go on.
Right.
And given the present situation of visitation at the Nebraska State Department of Corrections, that could be problematic. But to answer your question, Judge, could that have been put in place more firm? I guess, yes. And my client, I would, to her credit, I have to say this before, as I run out of time, to her credit, she didn't disagree with the judge when he said that Mr. Barber could be involved. Given the circumstances, given the facts, given what happened to her daughter, the minor child's stepsister, the fact that it was a sexual assault on a child, and given the fact that he was a registered sex offender, all of these things, of course, must, in my opinion, must come into play when one is determining what is an appropriate parenting plan or schedule. I think to Judge Cox's credit, he didn't abuse his discretion, and he set it out in a general parenting plan, knowing full well that as time goes on, this will have to be changed too, because the boy is young, and he will still be young when his dad gets out of prison.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
You are out of time, and I believe the appellant is out of time as well. So thank you very much for your appearance here today. Your case is submitted and you are excused. We again ask you wear your masks out of the courtroom and exit stage door left, or I guess to your right.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Stay well.